Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present independent investigative journalist and author Gareth Porter, who assesses the dangerous consequences that could result from President Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the International Iran Nuclear Agreement. Neela Banerjee of Inside Climate News, who discusses Trump Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt's actions that are rapidly turning over EPA decisions to industry priorities instead of the public interest. And Palestinian-American businessman and entrepreneur Faisal Saleh, who explains why he opened the first Palestinian museum in the U.S., relating the story of a displaced people. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The United Nations Special Rapporteur for Human Rights in Myanmar, Yang Hee Lee, is calling for an end to the escalation of violence in that Southeast Asian nation's northern border of Kachin State, home to decades of ethnic conflict. While global attention has focused on the atrocities committed against the Rohingya Muslim minority in Rakhine State, fighting has resumed along the border with China and India in Myanmar's Kachin State. The Guardian newspaper reports that humanitarian relief supplies were blocked from reaching Kachin's internal refugees in April by Myanmar's military, which used aerial bombing and artillery fire targeting civilian areas. Over 100,000 people have fled to camps for the displaced in Shan and Kachin states since a government-endorsed ceasefire crumbled in 2011. About 5,000 people protested in the capital of Kachin State on April 30th, demanding that the government rescue displaced civilians trapped in fighting between Myanmar's army and the Kachin Independence Army, an ethnic rebel group. On April 25th, more than 30 Kachin civil society organizations urged the UN Security Council to refer the Myanmar military to the International Criminal Court for what they say are human rights violations against civilians and the denial of humanitarian assistance to people in need in Kachin State. British Petroleum's 2010 Deepwater Horizon explosion killed 11 oil rig workers and spewed millions of barrels of crude oil into the Gulf of Mexico. That disaster provoked concern for worker and environmental safety, leading to the creation of the Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement, which is now at risk under the pro-fossil fuel Trump administration. The Bureau, staffed by 130 inspectors, has struggled to inspect 2,000 fossil fuel extraction projects from the Gulf of Mexico to the Alaska coast. The agency has investigated the death of oil workers in numerous accidents on drilling platforms. Concern has arisen about the agency's possible demise amid calls for energy deregulation by Trump's Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. The new director of the Bureau is an oil industry ally, Scott Angell, who has called for an era of government cooperation with the oil industry. Weeks after the 2016 election, the agency was dealt a blow in the courts, which sided with industry and ruled that the Bureau had no authority to hold oil rig contractors liable for violations that could lead to spills, injuries, or deaths. By early 2017, the agency appeared to have abandoned what was once a priority, getting industry to report near misses with the aim of averting catastrophes. According to a 2013 study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, oil workers are now 7 times more likely than the average U.S. worker to die on the job. In late April, Flint, Michigan activist Leanne Walters won the prestigious Goldman Environmental Award for leading a grassroots campaign to test the city's tainted drinking water. Flint's drinking water was contaminated with lead after state and local officials began using the polluted Flint River as a source for the city's water supply. In 2015, Walter's children tested positive for lead exposure, and one of her twins showed signs of lead poisoning. Walters spearheaded a campaign to demand more water testing and brought in Virginia Tech University professor Mark Edwards, who conducted comprehensive water testing. When hundreds of water samples revealed high levels of lead in the drinking water, public pressure on Michigan Governor Rick Snyder forced the state to stop using the Flint River as the city's main drinking water source. But for all that Walters, Edwards, and Michigan State pediatrician Mona Hanna Atisha did for Flint, the awards follow an all-too-familiar pattern. Flint is more than 50% Black, yet prizes for heroism have been the exclusive domain of non-Black figures. Black residents who were active in bringing attention to Flint's water crisis have not been recognized. Many African Americans in Flint, observed Derek Z. Jackson, a fellow with the Union for Concerned Scientists, looked like helpless victims relying on non-Black doctors and scientists to save them. It's a type of modern racism, Jackson asserts, that appears in many forms all around us. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
As long anticipated, President Trump announced on May 8th the U.S. withdrawal from the International Nuclear Accord with Iran that was negotiated by his predecessor, Barack Obama. While Trump stated that his administration would initiate new sanctions against Iran, the president stands virtually alone in the world with his condemnation of and now decision to leave the nuclear agreement. The other nations that signed the accord with Iran, Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, and the EU, all say they will work to preserve the accord despite the U.S. exit. According to UN inspectors, Iran has remained in compliance with terms of the deal in force since 2015. However, with its withdrawal, the U.S. is now in violation of the agreement. In response to Trump's announcement, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani said he had ordered his nation's atomic industry organization to be fully prepared to once again start the industrial enrichment of uranium without limitations. Many observers fear that the U.S. withdrawal will strengthen hardliners inside Iran and provoke a new nuclear arms race and conflicts across the Middle East. Your reporter spoke with Gareth Porter, independent investigative journalist and author of the book Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Here, Porter assesses the dangerous consequences that could result from President Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the Iran nuclear agreement.
Just to start with the dire consequences for the Iranian side, particularly if you consider the Iranian side to be the government of, you know, President Rouhani, this is a government that, although it is clearly not a single faction controlling the policy completely, represents a point of view on Iranian foreign policy, which is still quite favorable to integration of Iran into the global economic system, as well as into a set of relationships with Western countries, including the United States and also, of course, key European states. That has been an aim of Iranian foreign policy for many years, and this government is in line with that aim completely, but it is under great pressure at home from a much more powerful nationalist political views and political factions, which have been extremely critical of the agreement with the United States to begin with. So from the point of view of the Iranian government, this is a big blow, not only to their policy, but also to their political position within the Iranian political system. I think that it means that they will be under increasing pressure to take a much harder line, clearly, and will face political consequences at home from their point of view if they don't take a much harder line, meaning that they respond with some fairly strong changes in their policy toward the nuclear program, at the very least resuming the enrichment program in some fashion. And I would suspect at least having some nominal enrichment at higher level, if only very limited, to show that they are not going to be limited in that regard. So I think that is the very least that we can expect from Iran in terms of response to this.
Gareth Porter, with Trump's withdrawal from this international nuclear accord, will other nations that sign the accord be able to hold it together, or is the whole thing fall apart?
No, I don't think that the European states, the UK, Germany, and France, will be able to hold it together. I think they've been striving mightily to do that in their contacts with Iran, of course, but also logically, necessarily, in their contacts with the Trump administration and with Trump himself. But I think the lesson of the past few months is that there is no way to square the circle. There's no way that the Europeans can continue to have a deal with Iran in the absence of a commitment by the United States to do this. And in part, that's because the United States wields this economic power over Europe and makes it very difficult for Europeans to continue to have a deal with Iran that would be sufficiently rewarding to Iran so that Iran has a real incentive to continue in some way with, an agreement that is not with the United States, but only with Europe.
Gareth, I wanted to ask you this. Explain to our audience the kind of endgame that Trump, his newly appointed National Security Advisor John Bolton, and newly confirmed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, what do they have in mind in terms of an endgame with Iran if this accord no longer exists? It seems that with all the saber-rattling we've heard from these individuals and Donald Trump himself, that they're not too subtle about the idea that they'd like to go to war with Iran. At least that's what it appears on the surface. What are your thoughts?
Well, I can't disagree fundamentally with that analysis. I think that if we go back and look at what John Bolton's history is on Iran, when he was in the policymaking position in the George W. Bush administration from 2001 to 2005, he was very deeply involved in a scheme to try to wreck any possibility of an international agreement that would prevent or would make it more difficult politically, let's put it that way, for the Bush administration, and of course, particularly Vice President Dick Cheney, to plan for a use of military force against Iran. I have no doubt that Bolton really means what he says. He's been calling for bombing Iran for many years as a commentator on Fox News, and every time I've seen him talk about Iran over the years, he always says, yes, we should bomb Iran. So I think that's what we're up against here with the Trump administration. I must say that we have to view the next 2.5 years of the Trump administration as one of really grave danger for world peace and for the United States.
That was Gareth Porter, independent investigative journalist and author of the book Manufactured Crisis: The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump regime's decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When the Trump administration came to Washington in January 2017, Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt was among the president's most controversial cabinet appointees. Long before Pruitt took over at EPA, he was well known for his climate change denier views and close relationship with the fossil fuel industry when he earlier served as Oklahoma Attorney General. While Attorney General, Pruitt had filed 14 lawsuits on behalf of the state attempting to overturn EPA air and water quality standards. But after more than a year in office, Pruitt is now tangled in a web of multiple scandals, including racking up over-the-top first-class travel expenses, lavish spending on dubious security measures, an ethically questionable decision to rent a room in Washington, D.C., tied to an energy lobbyist, and a taxpayer-financed trip to Morocco to discuss the export of natural gas on behalf of a lobbyist friend. While the Republican-controlled Congress has taken a few modest steps to begin scrutinizing some of the many scandals now plaguing Pruitt, the EPA head has succeeded in pursuing the Trump administration's agenda of dismantling critical functions and enforcement capacity of the agency. Your reporter spoke with Neela Banerjee, senior Washington, D.C. correspondent with Inside Climate News, who discusses her recent article titled, Pruitt's EPA is on the verge of regulatory capture. which finds that EPA decisions are now based on industry priorities instead of the public interest.
The EPA, in its 47-year history, is at the closest point to having its agenda dictated by industry rather than by the central precepts of its founding, and that is the protection of human health and the environment. There was a team of 10 researchers who worked on this study. It's in a peer-reviewed journal. And what they did was they looked at the history of Scott Pruitt's EPA in, you know, over the last year or so, and the various steps it's taken to basically roll back all sorts of regulations, not just in the climate space, but on other issues as well. The researchers also succeeded in interviewing, I think, about 45 current and former EPA staff members, including people who'd been there in previous years when other administrations, most notably under Ronald Reagan, tried to roll back regulations. But from what they've seen as far as the speed and ambition of what Pruitt is trying to do, what the veterans have seen of about what's happening under Trump versus what was happening under Reagan, they think that this goes much farther than anything else that's happened in the agency's history.
Now, I wanted to ask you about Pruitt's role here, because he seems to have struck out a real, I think, quirky place for himself in the agency, in that he has conducted his business in real secrecy and trying to prevent information flowing to other staff people in the agency, the careerists who've been there for many years and many decades, trying to keep them isolated. Maybe just speak to the covert action of what's going on inside the EPA right now.
There's a real dismissiveness about the expertise that exists within the EPA. And I think this feeds into the broader narrative within the Trump administration and those who support Trump, that you have this quote-unquote deep state that works against the interests of Americans, and therefore anything they say is suspect. And so Pruitt has been operating off that by basically cutting off access to the administrator's office of a lot of career scientists and other staffers. That sort of exclusion of expertise has extended to other bodies that exist that are linked to EPA. For example, EPA has these scientific advisory boards that are staffed by mainly by academics, but also some members of industry. But it's definitely tilted towards independent academics. And Pruitt has worked to make sure that there are fewer academics and a lot more people from industry. So, again, you know, that kind of independent expertise is being set aside to push forward an agenda that helps industry that was basically known about. Scott Pruitt is very much keeping in line with his history predating his time at EPA.
Neela, I wanted to ask you about the intersection between the many scandals roiling around Scott Pruitt that have captured many more headlines than his dismantling of EPA internal policies and regulations. But what is the intersection between these scandals, where it seems like he's doing all sorts of very lucrative favors for his friends in the fossil fuel industry and others, and blatantly violating many ethical rules?
Right. So Mr. Pruitt currently faces 11 investigations. Most of them are probably through the Inspector General's office. But there are 11 separate investigations into decisions he's made, like the money that was spent on this soundproof chamber or booth where he holds certain conversations, to his use of first-class tickets. But where his decision to kind of bypass traditional ethics intersects with his support of fossil fuel agenda has been his housing decisions in D.C. So if you'll recall, last year, between February and August, for about 6 months or so, he was paying $50 a night to stay at a very nice condominium in Capitol Hill that's owned by the wife of an energy lobbyist. The gentleman in question, Stephen Hart, said that he didn't have any business before EPA. He wasn't an energy lobbyist. But basically, journalists, you know, looked at filings by his company, and people did a lot of research and found out that his company at least does lobbying on energy, that he had also reached out to EPA last August on behalf of a client of his, Smithfield Foods, which is a major meat processing concern. And so It would be one thing if he stayed in property owned by a lobbyist at a cut-rate price. But the fact that the lobbyist works on issues that are within the purview of EPA shows this kind of intersection of his priorities and his certain attitudes towards ethical guidelines.
That was Neela Banerjee, senior Washington, D.C. correspondent with Inside Climate News. Find a link to Banerjee's article, Pruitt's EPA is on the verge of regulatory capture, and related information by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. April 22nd marked the grand opening of the first Palestinian museum in the U.S. Tucked into a modern office building along a suburban road, not far from downtown New Haven, Connecticut, the Palestine Museum U.S. is the creation of a Palestinian-American businessman and entrepreneur, Faisal Saleh. Members of Faisal's large and prosperous family were among the hundreds of thousands of Palestinians forced out of their homes when the State of Israel was declared on May 14, 1948. Each year, Palestinians commemorate May 15th as the Nakba, Arabic for catastrophe. The exhibits at the museum, paintings, photos, crafts, and historical items, fill several rooms and hallways of a building that Saleh owns. On display are works by Palestinian artists living in the Middle East, as well as those scattered in the global diaspora. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus visited the museum and spoke with Saleh about what motivated him to pursue the museum project, how he succeeded, and the response it has generated thus far.
Really thinking about, you know, what's going on in the U.S. and around the world, there's really a vacuum of Palestinian media, and particularly when it comes to art and culture. And Israel and its friends have many, many museums everywhere, many cities in the U.S., and the Palestinians did not have a single museum in all of North America and South America. So that vacuum really is crying out for some presence, and that's really why I wanted to take this initiative.
And how did you get the different items, the different artists who are exhibited here?
Well, I began the process of researching the Palestinian artists mainly through Facebook. And I began making contacts with these artists. And initially, it was difficult to get an artist to agree to exhibit at the museum and send us their artwork kind of sight unseen. However, after a while, once we got a couple of names under our belt, particularly, there's an artist, a Palestinian artist who was very famous, who lives in the U.S. in New York. That's Samia Halabi. I made contacts with her, and she came out here and had a lot of questions for me. And after vetting us very thoroughly, she said she really liked what we're doing and thought it was a great idea. And she said, "You will have three of my paintings on loan to exhibit." And after that, that was really a turning point. After that, it became much easier to get artists to send us their work. And after the coverage we've had recently on the international media outlets, everybody wants to send us their art now. So we have a huge pipeline of work we're just waiting to decide on.
I think I read you quoted as saying at some point that when people in the U.S. talk about Palestinians or talk about the West Bank or talk about Gaza, it's all about politics and fighting, and most people in the U.S. have a very one-dimensional view of Palestinians, and that part of your goal was to make the Palestinian people sort of more three-dimensional. Is that right?
That's true. I mean, the media in the U.S. in particular and the West in general kind of focused on violence and conflict and terrorism and things like that. And kind of portrayed Palestinians in a negative light, if you will. The average American doesn't really know much about Palestine and Palestinian. They think Palestine is Israel. and they think hummus and falafel are Israeli food. The Palestinian culture has been raped, in our opinion, and we Palestinians are out to reclaim our culture. Falafel is a Palestinian food, but had been a Palestinian food for hundreds of years. So we hope that by exhibiting all the art, the Palestinian art, and showing the historic photographs, that we can provide the American audience with a picture of who the Palestinians are, and show that they're really human beings like everybody else, and they have the artists, and they have people who excel in the arts, and the musicians, and the people that do the crafts, and the photographers, and all that. And our goal is to change the discourse from the political arena to the cultural, artistic arena.
You said it's not political, but there's a big painting in there. There's one big painting that seems to be very political. You know which one I'm talking about?
The Rachel Corrie Memorial.
Yeah. I should just say Rachel Corrie was a young college student in her early 20s who did go to Gaza and worked, basically was run over and killed by a bulldozer when she was defending a family's home in Gaza. So how did you decide to include that one? It's probably the biggest one in the whole exhibit,
yeah,
isn't it?
It's a mural. Mm-hmm. It's an 18-foot by 8-foot mural. I felt that, you know, Rachel Corrie was such a brave, selfless person that, you know, why would a young woman like her leave her comfortable life in Olympia, Washington, and go to like one of the worst places on earth? And she lost her life in something she believed in, and it was a tragedy. And you know, we're not concerned about whose fault it is and whatever, but we're concerned about her sacrifice, and the Palestinians honor her everywhere.
That was Faisal Sayla, founder and executive director of the Palestine Museum U.S. Sayla says his museum is a proof of concept that he hopes can be moved to a bigger city in the near future. Learn more about the Palestine Museum by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Radio Helsinki in Graz, Austria, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, KOPA in Pala, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.